Blog Talk Radio.
Do you want Detroit sports talk done right?
Yeah!
If you want it, you got it. It's Detroit sports talk with attitude. It's the Knee Jerks with Eno and Big Al.
Listen, I like Angelot.
That's driven in the air toward left field, way back. Brandon Inge puts the charge into another one. It's gone!
I like him a lot.
Culpepper. Jordan dropped him as he throws. Deep downfield, Calvin Johnson. And he's going all the way. Touchdown, Lions.
Brent Jiggins. And stuck. The reverse slam by Tayshaun Brent.
It's time to put on the knee brace and get ready for a workout. It's two guys who know Detroit sports. Here's Greg Eno and Al Beaton.
Monday night, 7 p.m., June 13th, 2011. You're listening to the Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm Al Beaton, a.k.a. Big Al, of the blogs Wayne Fonts Experience and Bless You Boys. It would be WayneFonts.com and BlessYouBoys.com. Every Monday night, we spend an hour and a half, 2 hours just talking what's ever on our mind when it comes to Detroit sports. And my co-host, the man I call Mr. Excitement, the voice of reason, and several other names that I can go on for 90 minutes, but that would be one Greg Eno of GregEno.com. Mr. Eno, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. It's a wonderful evening in Metro Detroit. This is the kind of weather that I like in June, where it's in the 70s, nice and cool in the evening. You don't have to put the air conditioning on, and a breeze coming through the house. It's this is my kind of spring weather, not our late spring, early summer weather, not this 90-degree stuff we had last week. But I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/GregEno, and follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter. The kneejerks.info will take you to our Twitter page, and our Facebook fan page, of course, is facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, where you can get updates on the show. And you can also write us at thekneejerks@gmail.com. Tonight, Al and I are going to go guestless. We do this on occasion. We're just the two of us pontificate. We're going to go about 90 minutes tonight. We both have some commitments later in the evening, so the shorter show kind of helps us out. So we'll be with you here until 8:30 tonight, and then next week we'll be back with another show. We're not sure who the guests will be next week, so once again, keep your eyes on Twitter and on Facebook to see who those folks might be. Also, want to remind everybody that the show is coming to you through the Blog Talk. I keep saying Blog Talk, through the Sports Geeks Radio Network here at SportsGeeksRadio.com. I want to remind everybody to come back to SportsGeeksRadio.com for a sports podcast throughout the week, including our show, of course, the Sports Geeks Twitter Roundtable, Sports Talk Soup, Average Joe Sports Show. And I think there's a new one out there, too. I forgot the name of it right now. There's yet another one they just brought on board here on SportsGeeksRadio.com. So come back to SportsGeeksRadio.com for some interesting sports programming throughout the week. Al, before we get started with what you want to talk about, let's play Whose Birthday Is It?
All right. That's right. I need to fire away, don't I?
Yeah.
All sure. Right. One moment here. Here we go.
I like the part when they go, "Happy birthday, dear." That's my favorite part. The way this works, folks probably know by now, is that I give Al a clue or two to begin with. This is the birthday of somebody who was born on this date. It could be a person who's living, a person who's dead. In the world of sports, today is their birthday, and I give Al clues throughout the program. Usually doesn't take him very long, and he tells me who he thinks that person might be. Now, tonight's Whose Birthday Is It? The subject was born on this date, obviously, in 1903. He is no longer living. He was born in 1903 in Forksville, Pennsylvania, and he attended Whedon High School. And at Whedon High School, he earned himself 16 varsity letters in four sports: football, baseball, basketball, and track. So those are the first clues to whose birthday it is.
Oh, God, I would have no idea at this point. You know what, I'll just throw out, I wouldn't see, if he was born in 1903, that would make the, wow. Yeah, I have no idea right now. I'm going to have to wait for another clue. They would say, pass to Betty White.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the first clue of whose birthday is it. So, no guests tonight, just Al and I until it's about 8:30 tonight. We've got a number of subjects to talk about. Lots of stuff going on, from the Tigers to the Lions to the Major League Baseball realignment to LeBron James, of course, what went on there at the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup Finals, all sorts of things going on. So let's plunge right into it.
Yeah, indeed. It's always a good day when the Tigers in first place and LeBron James didn't win a championship. So
right.
No complaints on this end. So
sure.
Obviously, and we're going to talk about both, but we should start with somewhat of a sad note. You know, you hate to start that way, but you know, especially for guys our age. You know, we're of the, as that TV show is titled, men of a certain age, and. And one of the guys that was a very important Tiger of our very young youth, you know, like he was a very a starter on the 1968 title team and on the 72 playoff team, and that is Jim Northrup passed away last week. I think it was last Thursday. I believe he was 71 years old. Jim Northrup was he spent almost his entire career in Detroit. I believe he spent his last year like in Baltimore or something like that. But he was almost a career Tiger. He's associated with the Tigers, and obviously he was a very important offensive bat with the Tigers, especially he had the knack for the Grand Slam. He became well known for his – he hit two Grand Slams in consecutive innings in a game in 1968. But he was a very good player for a very long time who just happened to have the bad luck to have played in a down offensive era that was dominated by pitching. You know, you look at his stats and you think, you know, what? But – you got to factor in that, you know, guys are winning ERA titles with ERAs under 1.5. So a guy who could hit 20 home runs in that era was a very, very good player. And Jim Northrup was a solid player. I know you wrote a blog post about your thoughts on Jim Northrup, which I really enjoyed.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the gist of what I had written was my experiences with knowing Jim, specifically the famous triple he hit in the 1968
yeah.
World Series in Game 7. The go-ahead triple that led the Tigers to victory in Game 7. And, you know, for years and years and years, the story was that Kurt Flood, of course, of Cardinals center fielder, tripped, stumbled a little bit going back for the ball.
Yeah, he misplayed the ball that he broke in first and all that, yeah.
Right. Right, and the thought was that because of that, and only because of that,
mm-hmm.
did that ball get over Flood's head and thus end up being a triple. I had was producing a TV show back in 1998 that Northrup was co-hosting with Jim Hawkins, the still around covering the Tigers for Oakland Press,
yeah.
What have you. And we got to talking about that triple, and I made the mistake of asking him about something about the Kurt Flood thing.
Yeah.
And he launched into this expletive-filled, not directed toward me, but directed toward everybody else who
right.
he's had an encounter over the past 30 years at that point, very upset that anybody would – he was very adamant that ball was not going to be caught, regardless if Flood had gotten a good jump on it or not.
Right.
And it really – I could tell that his face was getting red. I could tell that it really bothered him that he was lugging around – this was 30 years later
yeah. –
all of that baggage of having to hear for 30 years that – I think he probably felt that somehow diminished
yeah.
his – because Northrup was a very proud, very proud guy, and he didn't like the notion that his triple was tainted by the fact
yeah.
that Flood had stumbled. And he was very adamant. And subsequently, upon the passing, the news of his passing, a lot of Tigers teammates of his have come out publicly and have reiterated what Jim had said, that no, nobody would have caught it. It was not catchable. There's still some people who debate that, and I guess you could debate it until the cows come home. You'll never know. But the video of it, if you go to YouTube, you see this. But it's kind of inconclusive because the camera kind of cuts to Flood a little bit late, so you don't really know, and you really can't get a good idea of the trajectory or anything like that. But Jim Northrup was very adamant that that ball would not have been caught. And it dawned on me at that point, like, this guy has been carrying around a lot of baggage for 30 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was a just a good Tiger. He was a Michigan-born guy. You know, he played football like a lot of these other guys did, like Freehand did and Norm Cash did. You know, stars in multiple sports who lived in Detroit, the Detroit area, year-round. He was always a Michigan guy. He never, even when he played in Baltimore for that year, he stayed. He made his home here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a lot of things about talking to him that were kind of neat. His very caustic relationship with Billy Martin, how much he loved playing for Earl Weaver in Baltimore, Brooks Robinson. He was a big Brooks Robinson really took him under his wing and made him feel comfortable in Baltimore when he first got there. And just things like that, and how Norm Cash found out about how he was cut, and how Northrup didn't like the fact that Cash found out he was being cut by on the radio on the way into the game and in the ballpark, and storming the Ralph Houck's office and talking about that and protesting that, and being sold to Montreal and not wanting to go to Montreal, but the Gene Mauch, who's the manager of the Expos, talked him into it, and all these things I never knew about kind of behind the scenes things with the Tigers. And Jim was a guy, and I ran into him about 8 years later. I did a roundtable for the magazine I was editing, and he was part of it. He and Jerry Green and a couple other guys were talking about realignment, interleague baseball, and a lot of the stuff that I'm telling you that I found out, and I also shared in the piece, was stuff that I just. He told me over the phone. I mean, a lot of this stuff was just, he would just get on the phone with you, and he'd throw him a few batting practice pitches, and he would just go off, and he would just talk, and that's what was so nice about him. But it was genuine. It was just genuine. It wasn't just to hear himself talk. He wasn't a blabbermouth or a loudmouth or an obnoxious guy. He just talked, and he just liked talking baseball. He liked sharing his stories with people, but they were genuine. You knew there was no question where Jim Northrup stood on any issue. You knew exactly what he was. No wishy-washiness about him whatsoever. And he could be abrasive and kind of come off at times, kind of cranky. But I tell you what, he was a very, like you said, a good Tiger, probably an underrated player. You mentioned the fact that he hit all those home runs and all those grand slams, and you also mentioned the fact that it was during a pitcher's dominated era, and you're right about that. I mean, my goodness, I think it was after the '68 season is when they lowered the mound,
right?
Because of the pitching dominance. And Bob Gibson, the 1.12 ERA. The other the cool thing, Al, I didn't get this from Jim, but I got this from one of the obituaries I read about his life, was that triple that Northrup hit. Now, mind you, this was in Game 7 of the World Series. This is literally the last game of the season. Was the only triple that Bob Gibson surrendered the entire year, which was both as a testament to Northrup and to the year that Bob Gibson had, which was an incredibly dominant year.
Year of the pitcher. They call it year of the pitcher for that reason, of course.
Right. The American League batting champion was Charlie Yastrzemski with a .301 batting average. That led the league. And Gibson, only triple he ever surrendered was the most important triple of the whole season. And I've been dreading this. I'm sure you have too, because we're both about the same age. Dreading the time when all these '68 Tigers start to go. And I'm not trying to be morbid, but this is the beginning of it now. I mean, Jim was 71. Yeah. These other guys are about that age, a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to wonder, athletes for whatever reason don't tend to live as long as other people. Maybe it's just the life they lead or whatever. But we're going to start. I'm afraid that we're going to start to read about these kind of guys going in the next 5 to 10 years. You'll read about them every couple of years or so, and it's a shame. But nobody can live forever, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But just a solid, not a Hall of Famer, not an All-Star, just a solid player. And some of his former opponents, pitchers, have come out publicly and said how tough of an out he was, and he was a very difficult guy to strike out. He was in poor health recently, lately, but, I think one of the guys that really defines that '68 season.
Yeah, yeah, he was definitely a player that any team in the league could win with. He was, you know, he could have played for, right. He could have played anywhere. He really could have.
Sure.
And
sure.
Let's not forget, also, he was a broadcaster as well. He
sure.
He was a he was the color man for several years. Back in the days of pre Fox Sports Detroit, when it was the Pro Am Sports System, PASS, if I remember,
yep.
It was him and Larry Osterman, if I remember right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and even then you could tell he was no holds barred as a color man either. He, you know, he said what he thought, and that's what made him enjoyable as a broadcaster.
Right. I remember he was talking about interleague play, and I remember he was talking about how it was he who went to Jim Campbell back in the 6 years or 7 years or something like that, and said that suggested that there be interleague play to make the games more exciting, and it was this was before the DH, and Campbell said to him, well, we already have interleague play. And Northrop said, what are you talking about? He says, they're called spring training games. And Northrop said, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. And then, of course, a bunch of expletives came after that as well. But anyways, Jim Northrop, good guy, and definitely will be missed. No question.
Indeed. And actually, I would make a good segue because we wanted to talk about this anyway. So why don't we just do it before we get to the Tigers? And that would be the realignment that is rumored to be discussed. I guess there's nothing obviously in concrete yet, but it really could be that, you know, Major League Baseball, or as a lot of entities do, are floated it out there for the media to report on, to get people, you know, get thoughts on it, just see how exactly it would go over. But supposedly there is a talk of realigning actually both leagues, going to no divisions, 15 team in each league, 5 teams per league make the postseason. One team would have to move from the National League to the American League. And thus, with odd numbered teams in each league, that would mean an interleague matchup every day. So it really is a huge shakeup. Not so actually in a kind of a way, it's kind of going back to the future, because, like, as for example, in 68, which was the last year of essentially one league, no divisions.
Right.
Whoever won the league went to the World Series. Mm-hmm. And so going to no divisions is interesting. And, you know, honestly, I am not such a traditionalist where I am not afraid of making a change like this. In some ways, it might – I don't know if it – sometimes change is good. And right now there's a lot of – a way the divisions are set up at the moment. This would be their chance to sort out where you have some teams that really aren't geographically aligned in the division they're in right now. We could do away with the with how current interleague play is always overloaded with for every Chicago Cubs, Chicago White Sox series, there's 3 Detroit Tigers, Pittsburgh Pirates series that no one cares about. This doesn't bother me at all. If they decide to do it, you know, great. If they decide not to do it, well, oh well. But I don't know. To be honest with you, as slowly as baseball makes any kind of change, and good Lord, they've never been able to come together on a DH, for Christ's sake, I don't see this happening anytime soon, just because of there's just so many, as I guess the best way, there's so many cooks in the kitchen when it comes to this kind of thing.
Well, you know, whether the change would happen soon or not, let's talk about it, because, you know, the thing that just strikes me about this plan now, like you said, they're talking about having 2 leagues of 15 teams each, meaning that one team from the National League would have to be switched to the American League. The speculation has been Houston or Florida, because of the rivalries that they would have with the Rangers and the Rays, respectively. But what kind of strikes me, though, Al, is that there's, I guess in this plan, they would have what, the top 5 teams in each league would make the playoffs.
Right.
Okay. At first blush, when I first my knee jerk, no pun intended, reaction when I think about this alignment is that obviously if there's no divisions, that takes away the excitement of divisional races, and since some divisions are always going to be not as strong as others, that's just the way it is. It seems like doing it this way, on the one hand, it assures that the best 5 teams in the league make the playoffs, which I guess is a good thing. But doesn't it take away some of the interest from the teams? If you're aligned in the 3 different divisions of 5 teams each, for example, and maybe you say, okay, the 3 divisional winners make it, and we're going to take 2 wild cards of the remaining teams to make up our 5 teams, if that's what they're hell-bent on doing. doesn't it appear that by doing it this way, by putting all teams in one in with no divisions and taking the top five, while that might be good in terms of rewarding those top five teams, doesn't it potentially make the other 10 teams irrelevant early on? I mean, it seems like let's say we're in mid-July and now you got the top five teams and you got the other 10 that aren't really into it. They're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not really in it. But if they were in divisions, they'd be in it.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering. It surprises me that baseball would consider any alignment that would take away. Because one of the reasons that they even introduced wild cards to begin with was to bring more interest to more cities.
Right.
To say, okay, your team may not be in the divisional race, but you're still in this wild card hunt, even if you're not really in it. But you know that goes, or the wild card mm-hmm. standings. Our team's only six teams out of a wild card, even though there's seven teams ahead of us. But I mean, the thing is that's why they started the wild card to begin with. It seems like now they'd be kind of stepping away from that and saying, okay, here we're going to reward the top five teams. That's great, but you other 10 teams, you know what? Maybe your team would have been excited about your team's chances in mid-August because maybe you were playing in a division that wasn't all that strong and you were within sniffing distance of first place, but now with this new alignment,
mm-hmm.
you're buried in ninth or tenth and you have no prayer, of making the playoff. It just seems to me that this would eliminate more teams from contention earlier than normal. And I don't understand why my baseball would consider that, because I thought the whole thing was about money, and I thought the whole thing about money was keeping interest as long as possible in as many cities as possible, so you can get that ticket revenue.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like this would kind of shut out those other 10 teams that aren't among the top five. Now, I'm sure it's like anything else. You might have a year where maybe 10 teams are vying for those five spots because it's mm-hmm. such a tight division, tight race. But aren't there also going to be years, Al, where don't you run the risk of shutting out teams from contention that may otherwise have been in contention had there been divisions?
Yeah, very possibly. Yeah, it's in some ways it's probably definite, but that would be, I think, the compelling argument against it. That would be the biggest argument, I think, against it, is the fact that for some teams it literally would end their season almost before it starts, because especially a team that is in that would at least have a puncher's chance, say, in a weaker division, look at the years where the East could have had like four teams that were right. of a playoff caliber. And then the rest of the league is literally going for that one spot, but in some ways division spreads the wealth. That makes a lot of sense what you bring up. Maybe a better solution would be just to start rearranging divisions, moving some teams around divisional wise. Trying to do their best to even those things out rather than having some, because there's some lopsided divisions out there. When you look how things are at right now, with for example the NL Central, has six teams in it, while like the AL West has four. So that's the kind of thing that maybe that's what in their mind that they're trying to eliminate. But you could do that by just playing around with the divisions itself without having to eliminate divisions altogether.
Well, I think the way they're doing it now, they're really trying to stay true to the geographic part of it. The West is the West. The Central mm-hmm. is the Central. The East is the East. And that's why, you see, okay, four teams in the West, AL West, Texas, Seattle, Oakland, and Anaheim. Well, who else are you going to put in the West? Because if you're going to do geographically, those four teams obviously make the most sense to be in the West.
That's why the Astros are the obvious team, because then they could actually, or for that matter, get the Astros out of the Central, the NL, and put them in the AL West. And then that does open up more scheduling cans of worms as well.
Well, and that's the thing we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about the fact that, obviously with the 30-team, and some folks, and I'm not trying to insult the intelligence of people, but just so people know, the reason why that there's 16 teams in one league and 14 in another to begin with is mm-hmm. so that you have to have an even number of teams in each league, so that you don't have to have interleague play all the time. Obviously, those 14 teams can play each other all the time, seven games a night, And then the 16 teams in the NL could play themselves all the time, 8 games a night. Well, now if you do 15 and 15, now you've got an odd number, obviously, in each league, which is going to necessitate the need for interleague play every single day. Every day, there will be one interleague game under this proposal. Now, and that's another, that's enough for a lot of people to not want to even talk about this plan, because a lot of people are dead set against interleague play anyway and are tired of interleague play, frankly. It's run its course. You know, it's 13 years or whatever it's been, 13, 14 years. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to become among those folks who are kind of becoming weary of interleague play because it's taking away games that my team would play against teams in my league that I want to see more anyway. I would much rather see an extra 3 games or whatever against the teams from the AL East, for example, than mm-hmm. I would against the Pirates, the Rockies, or whoever else the Tigers are playing this year, the Mets and things like that. Now, so right there, that just the fact that you're going to have to play interleague play every single day may turn a lot of people off of this plan. Now, of course, the people that get turned off of this plan may not even be the people who matter, because you know we all know how much the fans matter in this whole thing anyway, as much as they like to think otherwise.
Right.
But I don't know if now the supposedly Major League Baseball Players Association according to sources, are willing to talk about this and are leaving the door open for this proposal. In other mm-hmm. words, they don't mind, they would not mind playing interleague play every day. That's the MLBPA. Now, I don't know. You know, I'm not sure if that's good or bad to have interleague play every day. Maybe the fact that interleague play is sticking out like a sore thumb now, and you only play it during certain times of the year, which is usually June, maybe that is what's turning people off. Maybe if you wove it in to an everyday schedule where it becomes less of a big deal, maybe in a strange way that would placate people like me who are weary of interleague play. Maybe that would, in a way, you know, make that more palatable. But frankly, there's a lot of question marks about this plan. It's strange. The fact that there's no divisions is strange.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. As they say, Back to the Future, I guess, what you might want to call it. You know, if the no division, divisional, you know, no divisions at all. That's what I found out about it. But it's, like I said, at the very least, it's something to talk about. And even though who knows if or when this could even happen, or even if this is the real plan, they could. Who knows? As we discussed, there's so many different ways they could go. But all right, with that out of the way, let's move on to the team that is actually in first place, amazingly enough, and that would be the Detroit Tigers. Over the weekend, they finally made it back into first place, and they're currently tied with the Indians. So actually, they're like a 0.002 of a percentage point behind them. But there are 3.5 games in front of the White Sox, 9 in front of the Twins. I believe the Royals are 6.5 back. Not bad for a team that was, 7-8 games out 3 weeks ago. And in that time frame, the Indians have collapsed. The Tigers have played some very good baseball, probably some of their best of the season, to the point where it's suddenly a horse race in the division. And honestly, I really do think the Tigers should be considered a favorite in the division. I called them that before the season started. But I guess the questions are now, I wanted to ask you, I know we talked about this on my other podcast, the Bless You Boys podcast we do every week over for the baseball blog. And which team in the division do you fear the most? Do you fear the White Sox? Is it do you think the Tribe has a chance at all of hanging around? And, of course, there's a lot of people, despite the Twins being pretty almost all season double digits back, are still scared. Crapless of the Minnesota Twins. Honestly, I really do think it's going to be the White Sox. It'll probably end up coming down to the Tigers and the White Sox. The White Sox have some players who have underperformed and are bound to get better, specifically Adam Dunn being the main one. And I could really see it could turn into a Tigers-White Sox race, because realistically, the Twins are an awful long ways back, and they have to leap 4 teams. The odds of that happening are so long. I think people are just the game 163 is still so fresh, and losing to the division in 2006 is still fresh in their minds that they fear the Twins. But you got to factor in the Twins are 9 games you know, going into midsummer is a long ways out of first place, which is why I'm tending to count them out. But I think the team to fear realistically has got to be the White Sox.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. They're only two games under 500, the White Sox. The whole Adam Dunn thing is scary because even though his losses, he looks at the plate. It's just like the Tigers need another bat. They're looking for Magdy Ordóñez to come back and provide that spark. If Adam Dunn gets his act together, all of a sudden the White Sox are a different-looking team.
Right.
They're a better team than Cleveland. I think they are. I think the White Sox are. And they're playing better baseball, and they're starting to feel a little bit better about themselves. I agree with you about the Twins. I mean, you're 13 games under 500, and you've got a leapfrog, like you said, four teams. That's not going to happen. But the White Sox, I think I'm not buying what the Indians are selling. They can't hit. They don't have no offense. And what's worse is that the fans seem to think, because I've been reading a lot of stuff on Cleveland.com, which is kind of like their version of MLive.
Yeah.
And a lot of people there are saying that there's really no hope that the Indians are going to spend any money to do anything.
Right.
Despite their fast start. And that they're probably going to not have enough paywall to do what they want to do. And they can't score runs. They have no offense. And their pitching is starting to falter a little bit. And then that late-inning magic that they had early in the year, we knew that wasn't going to be able to sustain itself. And that's starting to go away. And, so I think that it's – I agree. I think it's going to be the Tigers and the White Sox. I completely believe that. It's strange. The White Sox are only 3.5 games back of the Tigers and the Indians, but they're like 6 or 7 games back in the loss column, if you look at the loss column, because I think the White Sox have played like 3 or 4 more games than the Tigers and the Indians have. Tigers and Indians have. So that's why it's kind of skewed that way. And so it's a 3.5 game deficit, but it's kind of skewed because they played like 6 more games than, 5 or 6 more games, I think, than the Tigers and the Indians have. So that's a little bit skewed. It probably will come down to the Tigers and the White Sox, which I guess in the Tigers' case is a good thing because the Tigers have had the White Sox number lately.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's if I was going to bet, I would put my money on the Tigers right now, especially if it came down to the White Sox. As you said, the tables have turned from a few years ago where the Tigers could not buy a break against the White Sox, and now it's pretty much the other way around. But, that's the way it is in with baseball. Things tend to even out, even if it takes years. Speaking of a player you did mention as we were talking about who's the Tigers should be worried about, and that is Magdy Ordóñez. Tonight is his first game back. It's Monday the 13th. We're recording right in the middle of the Tiger game, actually. And he's getting to have his first at-bat shortly. And it was interesting that Ordóñez decided to spend almost an extra week in Toledo. I think he ended up playing another 4 or 5 games. Because he didn't, even though he was eligible to come back to Detroit, because of he felt his timing was off. He just didn't feel right at the plate, which I give him all kinds of credit for that. Figuring I'm better off trying to fix what's ever wrong in the minor league level than the big league level. But, actually the power started to come back in those last few games he stayed there. He hit a couple home runs in those last couple games, which has been a big issue here in Detroit that, he's turned into what everybody calls him Singleo. Yeah. And, I guess the question now is, what do the Tigers need out of Magdy Ordóñez to compete or to him be the missing piece? It's obviously a big issue with the Tigers has been the offense. For long stretches of the season, it's been pretty much Victor Martinez and Miguel Cabrera and not much else. Ordóñez in the three hole. And he was robbed of a base hit. At least he hit it hard. But Ordóñez was someone the Tigers are counting heavily upon to at least be essentially hit 300 and put up 20 home runs and close to 100 RBI. He's obviously nowhere near close to that, and he's not going to be close to that, but he could still close fast like he did a couple years ago. I guess the question is, do you think Magdy Ordóñez can still put the is Magdy Ordóñez still have enough left to put the Tigers over the top, I guess is what I'm going to ask you.
Well, I mean, that's the $64,000 question, I guess. Let's put it this way. He's at least, to me, in my mind, he's at least as good as what they've been putting out there, i.e. Andy Dirks. i.e. Ryan Rayburn, i.e. Don Kelly, those kind of players, I think he's at least going to give them that much. If he's what we think he can be still at age 37, it's an incredible upgrade from what they've been getting from some of the players in that lineup. To me, he at least presents to the opposition another veteran guy with a track record that you have to pay attention to. And you have to go into a game a little bit differently when you pitch to him than you would a rookie. Let's face it. I mean, I like the fact that Andy Dierks came up here, provided some energy, provided some initially a little bit of pop and what have you. And I love the Brendan Bosch situation. But, you know, let's face it. These guys are young. And, you know, you go up, you go through the lineup before the game, and you go through the batters, every one of them. And you come up in situations where you really love to have that veteran guy. I don't know about you, but when I see him in the batter's box, Manuel Ordóñez, I feel a lot more comfortable than I would with an Andy Dierks or any of these other guys. And it's nothing against those guys. It's just that he's been doing it for so long, and I don't know why you wouldn't feel more comfortable with a guy like that up at the plate in a situation like that. And that's the factor. That's the factor that you have. And then you also have, of course, the factor that the other team has to pitch these guys a little bit differently, maybe accord them a little bit more respect. And I like the fact that Jim Leland put him in sixth in the lineup as opposed to third and kind of took a bit of pressure off of him that way. But that's a tough question to just say, can one guy come in and be the guy? But I tell you what, the Tigers are just, it seems like we talk about this all the time, about they need offense. It seems like we've been saying the same thing for 3 years in a row now. And here we are again saying the same thing. But I'm telling you, if the way that this division is going right now, the way the Tigers starting pitching has been pretty consistent.
Yeah.
If they can get one more bat, whether that's Ordóñez, whether that's a second baseman from another organization, whether that's whoever it's going to come from, that offense, if they get one more guy in there that can produce, they'll walk away with that division. They will walk away with it. They just can't seem to find that. But if Ordóñez is that guy, boy, that'd be great.
Yeah, and remember, the Tigers are getting an unexpected amount of offense from both Johnny Peralta and Alex Avila. So if you could add in Ordóñez, he actually, even merely average Ordóñez, you know, a guy who hits 280 and, you know, has a 350 on base percentage, that's probably all the Tigers really need, if he ends up moving back into the three hole. But, and actually, I'm with you there. I would feel much more comfortable with Manuel Ordóñez batting higher up in the order than Brendan Bosch. Bosch has played well for long stretches, but he's also cold as hell for long stretches, and he tends to hack. He often swings at pretty much anything. I think Bosch is a better fit farther down the lineup, but he should be batting sixth or seventh. And I would feel more – actually, this is not another thing I've discussed. We've both discussed in the past that we think Manuel Ordóñez is actually – tailor-made to be the number two hitter in the Tigers' order. But considering there's not a true number three hitter, unless you want to move up, but then you start messing around with the who protects Miguel Cabrera if you move Victor Martinez into the three hole. So, and we know how Jim Leland is about comes batting order, but in a perfect world, I think Manuel Ordóñez is the Tigers' number two hitter, and he becomes a very, very productive number two hitter rather than throwing guys like Don Kelly and Ryan Rayburn in there as he's been wont to do. But, I'm with you in the fact that even an average Manuel Ordóñez may be enough offense to put this team over the top if the pitching holds up as it has so far. The Tigers' top rotation has been beyond excellent, especially now that Scherzer looks like he may be back after his nice start over the weekend. So, you make a good point in saying, as well as Bosch, Wells, and Dierks have been playing, you're right. You would feel more confident in the lineup as a whole with Manuel Ordóñez in the order, and then you still got those guys who are better defenders and do have halfway decent bats. They're perfect fits as number four outfielders right now. I don't think they are starting outfielders, especially Wells and Dierks. And being used as the backup outfielder in the corners, I think that is a perfect way to use these young players right now. And maybe in a couple years, there's your replacement for Manuel Ordóñez. But I think you're right now. They got to play. They need Maglio back. They need him to be at least a semblance of his former All-Star self, and that should be enough offense to get this team a division title.
Before we move on, let's give you one more clue in whose birthday is it. We are been derelict a minute. We got to give clue number two here.
Fire away.
The first clue was I was born in 1903 in Forksville, Pennsylvania, and I earned 16 varsity letters in four sports: football, basketball, baseball, and track at Wheaton High School. Next clue is I attended the University of Illinois, and I died on January
28th, 1991. Wow. University of Illinois, 1991. I'm just going to guess and say Red Grange.
You're right.
Oh,
the Galloping Ghost.
Oh, my goodness. I surprise myself sometimes.
You got it. Red Grange. He died at age 87 in 1991. Mm-hmm. Born on this date in 1903, Red Grange.
All right. Yeah,
good job.
Yeah, it was just kind of a matter of putting together the pieces and thinking of a guy. Okay, if he would have been, he would have been a huge star in the 1920s if he was born, as you said. So, how many, and about the only guy I know of at the University of Illinois that was a huge star back then would have been Red Grange. So, all right, congratulations to me. All right, let's get back to the Tigers. One of the guys I just brought up about getting unexpected offense is the Tigers catcher, Al Sevilla. All-star game talk is starting to come from the national media in regard to the Tigers catcher now. And you look at the stats, and it's well-deserved. He's hitting .297. He leads all AL catchers in OPS and slugging percentage. He's second in home runs and RBIs, and he's playing solid defense. And considering, and this is another discussion we've had in the past on the knee jerks, is that how bad overall catching is in the major leagues anymore. And really, the Tigers are getting plus offense and average defense out of their catcher. And in today's American League, that's essentially an all-star ball player there. That could be a perennial all-star out of the catching position with that, with that kind of a player. And this year, he's starting to put together at the plate. At the moment, he really is playing like one of the best catchers in the league, and he's finally the immense amount of faith the Tigers have put in him is finally starting to pay off. And I think that I have a feeling, even if obviously he's not going to win the vote, but he has an excellent chance to be picked as a reserve in the All-Star game, and it would be much deserved, well deserved, and he should actually.
Well, it's like anything else. You know, how many times have we talked about guys, you look at their numbers and say, well, he should make it. He should. Yeah, but there's so many factors. But this is actually a year now where Joe Mauer is not playing. I think he's played like nine games.
He leads All-Star voting, if I remember.
I know. What I'm saying is, though, if you're gonna look for reasons to tab somebody like Alex Avila, because, there's no guarantee that Mauer's even going to play in the All-Star game.
Right.
Then he is very capable.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the numbers. He's had a good year. And this is a guy that people wanted to have run out of town after opening day. That's good for him. He's been up to the challenge, and he's played well, and he's shored up, I think, his defensive game a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a nice smooth swing, and I think he's cutting down on the strikeouts. He's doing all the things right. He's becoming a very nice baseball player.
And
wouldn't it be great if the Tigers have found their catcher for the next 5 or 10 years? That'd be terrific, because really there's not a lot down on the farm right now.
Right.
It hasn't been for a long time at that position. They have not done a very good job of developing the successor to Pudge Rodriguez, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And now, maybe they got lucky with I should say lucky, because it does take something to scout these guys up. But lucky in the sense that they don't have anybody else.
So if
Avila wouldn't have panned out, then they would have had to look outside the organization, which would cost you more money. You're not going to pick up a catcher from outside the organization for pittance. That would cost money. Right now, you can get a lot out of Avila,
right,
without paying him a lot of money, because he's that new to the big leagues, he's not eligible to make that much money. So what you do is, from a business standpoint, you milk these guys for as long as you can milk them for the salaries that you're paying them, knowing darn well that sooner or later, if they pan out, you're going to have to pay the piper. And either that, or you're going to have to let them walk away. And so right now, you get as much out of them as you can for the dirt cheap price that I'm not sure what he's making, but it can't be that much money. It's got to be under $1 million, way under $1 million.
Right.
You know, you get what you can get out of him, because one day, if he progresses this way, one day you're going to have to pay the guy. And but that's down the line. Right now, having a nice year, and, you know, looking around the league, and Russell Martin, I know, has had a pretty good year for the Yankees. You know, there's a couple of guys that you could put up there as possible all-star catchers. But I'll tell you what, Avila's been very good.
Oh, indeed. And no, it's interesting to see is that the top two slugging catchers in baseball are both Detroit Tigers, and Avila, and of course Victor Martinez. And it's not, and it really isn't really that close. They're both slugging well over 500, and I think the next closest catcher in the American League, at least, is almost 100 points less slugging. So the Tigers really are getting an amazing amount of offense at a position that many teams get next to nothing out of nowadays. Speaking of next to nothing, we've got to talk a little bit about Ryan Rayburn. He's become this year's essentially the whipping boy. Anything goes wrong with the team, he's the guy that catches the brunt of it, just because of he's Ryan Rayburn. And he has had a really rough season. It was, but finally he was benched over the weekend. Jim Leland had seen enough, and he is playing tonight. But I guess at this point the question is how the breaking point's got to be coming soon with Rayburn. He's still hitting. If he's not under 200, he's really darn close. The glove, well, it is what it is, which means it's not good. And really, the Tigers might have a couple of better in-house options to play second base in Ramon Santiago and Danny Wirth. Danny Wirth has played very, very well in a platoon with Don Kelly at third base. So wouldn't you feel more comfortable going with some sort of a combination or what thereof of Santiago and Wirth, or for that matter, even Will Rhines, because at least these guys can field the position? I mean, I'm going to put it this way. If I'm going to put a guy who can't hit at a position, I at least want that guy to be able to pick it. And right now, Ryan Rayburn can't pick it, and he's not hitting the ball either. So I'm just wondering how much I guess the problem is Jim Leland tends to give guys enough rope to hang himself, and then he lets them twist in the wind. And I think we're getting to that point with Ryan Rayburn, where he's not only hung himself, he's twisting in the wind right now. And it was interesting to note that over the last game he played Friday, the boos were starting to show up in force. I mean, fans are beginning to run out of patience. The internet fans who are really deep into baseball, they've fallen off the Ryan Rayburn bandwagon long ago. But when the casual fans start to note that, well, no, this guy is not really playing very well, that's when you're really, really in trouble, because it's really hard to get that group of fans. It's kind of like he's going to turn into the one of the many Red Wings goalies who have fallen out of favor and end up having to be run out of town. So you got to put some of this on Leland, because I really don't think this is something we've talked about in the past. Leland tends to put players in a position to fail, and I think that's what they're doing with Ryan Rayburn right now.
Well, you know, you'd like to think it's a case of – the easy thing is to say, well, it's just a case of a square peg in a round hole. But in this case, mm-hmm. I don't know that – I think that Ryan Rayburn is just a square peg wherever you put him, because he's just not a big league baseball type guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a big league caliber player right now. And mm-hmm. you know, if anybody who read Regino.com knows that where I feel on Ryan Rayburn. And you know, I came out over the weekend with a pretty scathing piece about him and how the Tigers should get rid of him. You know, this is a situation where if they can get back to Ordóñez now and bring him back in the mix, if either Ordóñez can do his thing, or if you get second base figured out, and by figured out I mean looking outside of the organization, because obviously they don't have any answers within the organization.
Right.
That's all of a sudden the lineup is going to look a lot better. I think if come a month from now, as we're getting closer to the interleague trading deadline, July 31st trading deadline, knowing how much it should be noted, a couple of things should be noted also. Ryan Rayburn was pinch hit for on Friday night in that game you mentioned by Ramon Santiago.
Right.
Which is an indictment right there.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the first thing that happened. Secondly, Mike Gillich came into the clubhouse after the game on, I think it was yesterday, came into the clubhouse and which I think was the first time they said he had been in the clubhouse this year, you know, giving guys high fives, congratulating them, hugging them, you know, really fired up. And a lot of the players were quoted as saying how much that meant to them and how that got them fired up. And not even after Saturday's game, actually. And he had Saturday's win. It was after the win on Saturday. He came into the clubhouse, Ilitch did,
right,
and made the rounds and got some of the players fired up, and they appreciated that. And so that tells me, this was just because, I'm not sure it was just because they tied for first place on Saturday or not,
mm-hmm,
but that was coincidence. But that tells me that if he's doing that here in mid-June, Mike Ilitch, then if push comes to shove next month, and the Tigers are still, we suspect they'll still be in the hunt at that point, of course.
Right.
And if things, the landscape of the team is looking the way it is now, let's even say that Magui Ordóñez is hitting. In fact, let's say that. And let's say that second base is the only thing at this point that really needs to be figured out. Well, I wonder now if Mike Ilitch would give the green light to Dave Dombrowski to make, mm-hmm, some sort of a splash at the trade deadline to fix second base.
Yeah.
I know Jose Reyes has been mentioned, but there are other guys that maybe he could get as well that may not be quite as flashy or maybe not as exciting as Jose Reyes, but certainly better than what they've got right now. I don't know that you can win the division or make the playoffs with what they've got at second base right now, whether it's Santiago, as much as I hate to admit it, he's I don't think he is an everyday guy.
Right.
Rayburn, Worth, I just don't know that you can have half of an infield be Don Kelly / Brandon Inge and whoever you've got at second base.
Right.
Have that be half your infield and consider yourself a contender. It's,
mm-hmm,
even regardless of the division that you play in. I don't know that you can say that with a straight face. So this is telling me that I think we're on a collision course for the Tigers to make some sort of a play for somebody outside the organization when it comes to second base.
Yeah. Yeah, and there could be some decent players available. You know, there could be some teams having fire sales. So it's going to be a wait and see basis. Actually, it's going to be interesting to when the trade deadline comes along in about 6 weeks. It's going to be fun to watch and see what exactly the Tigers do, because there are some questions about, you know, how the Tigers are financially as well and how much they're willing to spend. Are they willing to spend big money on a guy who may have a long term contract? Or are they going to limit themselves to guys who are either cheap or are essentially going to be a three-month rental? So we'll just have to wait and see. One more thing before we move away from baseball. I wanted to ask you about the Major League Draft. Tigers had made their picks about this time last, I think it was like Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday was the Major League Draft. And I talked about it for about 20 minutes on the Bless You Boys podcast. I couldn't tell you a damn thing about the player. I still can't tell you a damn thing about the players they drafted. And I think if you talk to any baseball fan, you know, when it comes to the Major League Draft, as much as Major League Baseball tries to make something out of it, it's literally trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, because there's really nothing there. The Major League Draft, Major League Baseball Draft, I should say, it's boring. It really pales in comparison to the NFL and NBA drafts, where teams are getting instant help, which I think is really the biggest difference, is that that baseball teams are getting no immediate help. They're lucky if their draft pick shows up in a year or two in the big leagues. And for that reason alone, it's like, you know, talk to me in a couple years about some of these guys they pick. And then don't forget on the draft that it's so long that in the end of the draft, you got the Tigers drafting Mario Mpemba's kid and Rod Allen's kid and Al Kaline's grandson. And it's like, if that alone does not tell you about some of the ridiculousness of the Major League Baseball draft, you know, that's it in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not the only teams that do that. You mentioned players, you know, sniffing the big leagues within a year or two of being drafted. And a lot of times, though,
If
you're lucky. But the thing is, it's not even so much if you're lucky. Sometimes these players rush through to the big leagues to the detriment of both the player and the team. I remember when the Tigers did that with Andrew Miller.
Yep.
They rushed him a big, tall left-hander from, I'm not sure if it was North Carolina or North Carolina State or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they rushed him through. They drafted, I think they rushed him through to somebody drafted him, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And they rushed him into the big leagues. And let's not forget Cameron Maben, how he was rushed through, and that was no picnic either. You know, so sometimes I don't know what the theory is behind rushing players to the big leagues. I'm not sure if it's because they literally think that the talent is so good there that they're ahead of the curve, and that any time in the minor leagues would be, you know, not as productive as time in the big leagues. But you know, it's never going to attain, of course, the, mm-hmm. the level of the other drafts that you mentioned because of the fact there's not that instant help.
Right.
You know, there's not instant help, really. I mean, how many times have we seen a guy get drafted, and all of a sudden, unless you're a Steven Strasburg type guy, and unfortunately, even he had some arm issues. You know,
you could argue he was rushed as well. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. You know, and there's a lot of pressure, Al, to rush these guys. Sometimes there's pressure from the fan base. Sometimes there's pressure from ownership. Sometimes there's pressure from who knows what forces are at work to bring kids along. Now, obviously, in the case of Strasburg, you know, I don't think that, he was put on a fast track. There's a difference between being put on a fast track and being rushed. Strasburg clearly has a big league arm. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, that's not even an issue. Usually pitchers are a little bit further ahead than hitters anyway in that regard, before things catch up to them. But Strasburg was a guy that those kind of pitchers don't come along very often. So I can completely understand why the Nationals, especially the Nationals, mm-hmm. who are looking for anything to rejuvenate that franchise and to put fans in the stands and get interest going on their team, I can completely see why they would bring Strasburg along as quickly as they did. In fact, I was surprised they waited as long as they did.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to break spring training camp with them instead of, mm-hmm. I think he came up in May or June or whatever. And you know, that kind of surprised me. But then you can look at guys like Matt Wieters, you know, the catcher at Baltimore, who, you know, I don't know that he was ready for the big leagues, frankly.
Yeah.
I think he could have used a little more seasoning. You know, position players is more difficult. You know, it's more difficult for a position player, to come up and face big league pitching, which is nothing at all like college pitching. Let's face it. I mean, come on. I mean, there's nothing mm-hmm. close. I think a college pitcher can come in and maybe get some guys out initially because teams haven't seen him before. But I think for a position player to come up and all of a sudden be expected to hit a slider, a big league slider, a big league curveball, that's a tough deal. Then when you'll be a catcher on top of it all, one of the most important positions on the diamond. But again, the Orioles were a team looking for some sort of energy. I mean, that was a team last couple of years that has been really down. And so mm-hmm. I can see once again why they would bring a guy like Wieters along quickly. But you know, he suffered for that. I think he really suffered for that. Now you can say that it's good that they learn these lessons up at the big league level, but sometimes you run that risk of you're in that fine line of, am I doing him more good by giving him this exposure or am I doing him more harm? And I guess it has to do with the individual player. I think it's probably you can't really make a general blanket statement about that. But you do run that risk with these young guys of killing their confidence to the point where I'm convinced that's what happened to Cameron Maben.
Yeah.
And the Tigers brought him in, put him in the lineup against the New York Yankees of all teams at Yankee Stadium in a very important series at the time. This was back in 2007. The Tigers really needed it to get some wins. They were trying to scramble back into the race after kind of mm-hmm. falling out of it after the big, fast start. And then they put a kid like Maben in Yankee Stadium of all places. And I just, I'm not saying that alone did it, but he had a lot of bumps along the road, and then he went to Florida, didn't do much. Now I guess he's with San Diego. I think he's doing a little bit better with San Diego.
Yeah, but he's been nothing more at this point than an average to below average major league player. So it does make you wonder. But for that, I guess a guy you may even say might be a poster boy for this kind of thing is even though he wasn't a drafted by the Tigers, he was a high draft pick by Oakland. Who the Tigers then traded for, and then was immediately put in a starting rotation the next year, in Jeremy Bonderman. And sometimes I wonder how much better a pitcher he could have been if he had gotten that extra year or two in the minor leagues and maybe had developed that third pitch that everybody was crying for almost his entire career that he never really was able to do at the big league level when you're supposed to be doing that kind of thing at the minor league level. So I think right that there again, he was rushed. He ended up having an okay career, but I don't think it never really worked out. He was supposed to be – he had ace talent, but for a combination of being rushed, had injuries, and maybe, who knows? With baseball, it really does come down to a monstrous amount of luck at times with some of these guys. Like Brennan Bosch was literally he was not even considered a prospect 2 seasons ago. Now he's literally been the Tigers' starting corner outfielder for a season and a half. So that alone tells you just how hit and miss and how sometimes just the luck of the draw comes to trying to find major league ball players.
It does tell you that. And you know what I'm going to do, Al? I'm going to have to unfortunately cut. We're going to have to get into Jerk of the Week right now because I got to cut this short half an hour earlier than I thought. So I apologize
okay.
for that. I apologize to the
nope,
listeners.
Problem.
So remind everybody that next week we will be back on the 20th for another show. Keep your eye out on Twitter and Facebook for who might be on our show, facebook.com/theKneeJerks and theKneeJerks.info for our Twitter page. So I'm sorry about that, Al, but I got to cut it short, so let's get into
All right, no problem. Go ahead, and why don't you go ahead and fire away then.
Well, you know what? Usually, hockey players are generally not trash talkers. They're pretty good bunch of guys. They don't really get under each other's skin verbally. Now, they may get under each other's skin on the ice, of course, obviously. But they usually don't take shots at each other. But Roberto mm-hmm. Luongo, in the Stanley Cup Finals, after Game 5, when the Canucks beat the Bruins 1-0,
right.
Kind of raised some eyebrows when he indicated to the press that the goal that Tim Thomas let in, which was the only goal of the game, would have been a goal that he would have been a shot that he, Luongo, would have stopped. And it kind of raised some eyebrows because usually you don't hear that too much, especially in between goalies of all things. Usually goalies have the utmost respect for each other. Now, Luongo did backtrack a little bit after he was called out on that, and then he also made a reference to, well, you know, Tim Thomas hasn't said anything good about me. You know, but I just thought that it was just weird that Luongo, of all people, now this is a guy that was almost, you know, who had a horrible time at times
yeah.
against the Blackhawks in the first round when the Canucks almost blew a 3-0 series lead, largely because of Roberto Luongo, a guy who's had some question marks about his own clutch inabilities. And then he went to Boston for games 3 and 4 and just had horrific games in Boston. Boston coach Claude Julien basically said, well, you know, I don't think Timmy's going to respond to that, but all I'll say to you is I'm not sure how many goals. Look at how many goals the other guys let up, meaning Luongo, versus how many goals my guys
mm-hmm.
let up. And I just thought it was just a strange timing. I know he tried to backtrack on it a little bit, Luongo did, but I just thought it was very kind of I don't know why he would even go there, frankly. And so my Jerk of the Week is a Roberto Luongo for saying – for taking the I would have stopped it route against Tim Thomas.
All right. My Jerk of the Week, I'm going to go with Charlie Villanueva of the Pistons for his quote saying, I want, quote unquote, communication from my next coach. And this is coming from a team full of players who I think if you had the world's best communicator on the planet, these guys wouldn't listen to. And to come out and say we want a communicator as our next coach is just—it just goes to show how ridiculous this roster is, and just how clueless a lot of these NBA players are that the Pistons have on their roster right now. Just to say something as silly as this, considering they haven't listened to a coach since Chuck Daly left, for Christ's sake. Other than Larry Brown, there's Larry Brown. I think they listened to, and they got tired of listening to him after about a year and a half. So the Pistons just don't listen to coaches. So to say they want a communicator is absolutely asinine. So my Jerk of the Week, Charlie Villanueva for saying something stupid, which in the end is not he says it too, it happens quite often with him, I should say. So there's my Jerk of the Week. All right, Greg, ready to wrap it up?
Yeah, that's the quintessential pot calling the kettle black, what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
With Charlie V, but we should note that, of course, the Pistons are apparently have been given permission to talk to Kelvin Sampson of the Milwaukee Bucks. Mike Woodson, of course, doesn't need permission, but Mike Woodson's going to be talked to Lawrence Frank of the Celtics and Bill Laimbeer of the Pistons, of course, now with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Isaiah Thomas apparently not in contention. Joe Dumars saying he didn't want to risk the friendship between he and Isaiah. Well, you know, it might be just a nice way whatever. Take that as at face value. Follow us, please, on our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/theKneeJerks. You can listen to me here every Monday night with Big Al on the Sports Geeks Radio Network at sportsgeeksradio.com as we do the KneeJerks every Monday night at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. You can also follow us on Twitter. TheKneeJerks.info is the way to do that. And follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/GregEno. And, of course, read me every day at GregEno.com. I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon. And thank you, Big Al, for making Monday night so fun. Sorry to cut it short tonight, but we'll be back next Tuesday with another two-hour extravaganza.
Indeed. And as always, you can read me at WayneFontz.com, the Wayne Fontz Experience, BlessYouBoys.com, BlessYouBoys.com, and also the Bless You Boys podcast, which can be found at BlessYouBoys.com as well. We usually release that every Thursday or Friday. All right. And, of course, BigAl.us for my Twitter and AlBeaton.com for Facebook. You can friend me. I'm a nice guy. All right. Greg, I appreciate it. I'm sorry we had to cut it short, but no problem. We knew it was going to be a short show anyway. So, anyway, until next week, no problem. Until next week, we'll see you again next Monday at 7 p.m. This is Al Beaton saying aloha.
Ciao, everybody. We'll see you next week. Take care. Good night.